On the evening of February 25th, 2007, Christian author Philip Yancey was driving his Ford Explorer from Los Alamos, New Mexico, to his home in Denver after a busy weekend of speaking. He was thinking about his wife Janet and the wedding of one of their friends that they were attending in a few days. In the fading light, he didn't notice a sharp left curve ahead. Traveling about 65 miles an hour, he tried to negotiate it with when his vehicle began fishtailing. Yancey describes the moment. "I tried to correct, but as best as I can reconstruct what happened, my tire slipped off the edge of the asphalt onto the dirt. That started the Explorer rolling over sideways at least three times and probably more. Amazingly, the vehicle stopped right side up. All the windows were blown out, and ski boots, laptop computer, and suitcases were strewn over 100 feet or so in the dirt. When emergency personnel arrived, they strapped him to a rigid bodyboard and immobilized his head for the hour-long ride to the town of Alamosa. The early images of Yancey's neck revealed pulverized C3 vertebrae. The emergency room surgeon told him that the break didn't touch his spinal cord, but likely punctured critical arteries that served the brain. Just hours before, Philip Yancey was on his way home to his wife of 37 years. Now he's alone in the busy emergency room of a small community hospital, wondering if he will live beyond the next few minutes. Just after her baby was born, Nancy Guthrie knew something was wrong. All the plans and dreams shifted when Hope was born with club feet, extreme lethargy, and an inability to suck, among other problems. All symptoms of Zellweger syndrome, a disorder that causes the body to retain the toxins it normally throws off. Hope would live for 198 days. In the meantime, it was discovered that Nancy and her husband both had the recessive gene for Zellweger syndrome to occur. The Guthries decided David would have a vasectomy to prevent another pregnancy, but 1 year after Hope died, Nancy was pregnant again. Prenatal testing revealed their next child would also have Zellweger syndrome. Gabriel was born on July 16, 2001. They knew what to expect. Their son's first day was his best. You're going through a normal day when suddenly you hear the ambulance siren as it grows louder and louder. You've heard the sound many times before, but this time it's headed to your house. The moment seems separated from reality. Things that were important just minutes ago are completely irrelevant now. The telephone rings and you answer with no idea what is about to happen to your life. Right after you say hello, the caller tells you the news. You stand there in shocked disbelief as you hear that one of the most cherished people in your world to you is gone. There wasn't even time to say goodbye. There's a knock on the door and you open to a man who calls your name, then hands you a legal document on a clipboard for you to sign, acknowledging receipt of the document. You can feel time stand still. You knew your marriage was in trouble, but you had no idea. You scribble your name and shut the door. You can hardly breathe. Some of you haven't had one of these experiences yet. What are you going to do when the bottom drops out? Some of you have lived these stories or something similar. You felt weak. You felt vulnerable. You were afraid. What did you do? Life has a way of walking up and just smacking you in the teeth. These are times when you need the rock solid things that don't and won't change. And you need them nailed down before the crisis strikes. Because all you'll have in those moments is what you had before they hit you. Over the next several weeks, we're going to look at six foundational realities that you must have in place to build on. Bedrock truths that will get you through the crises that come in the course of life. What is the most important truth that you will ever hear? Well, Psalm 100 and verse 3 declares, "Know that the Lord, He is God. It is He who made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture." It's that simple, right? In America, year after year, the polls have reported that around 90% of us say we believe in God. But when the comfort of our life turns into chaos, that claim can prove to be hollow. Do you have this truth nailed down, that the Lord is God? Let's take a look at one person who did. Isaiah. When he faced a personal crisis, his testimony and his actions showed a man who had a clear view of God. Would you turn with me in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 6 in verse 1. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of His robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two He covered His face, with two He covered His feet, and with two He flew. And one cried to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory.' And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of Him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke." The first phrase of this passage reveals the crisis for Isaiah. King Uzziah, who had ruled over Judah for 52 years, was dead. Some of us that are here today can remember when President Kennedy was killed and how that felt. The news report began, "The president is dead." The throne of David was vacant. King Uzziah had died. The throne was vacant at the worst possible time because Assyria's army took advantage of that moment. They had wanted to invade. All of the people became preoccupied with the news about Assyria. And terror grew in every citizen's heart. Isaiah's world was just falling apart around him. And he begins this passage on his vision of God with King Uzziah was dead. After he indicated that King Uzziah was dead, he then saw God for who He is. And you know what? He never mentions King Uzziah again. What did he see? What did he say about God? And what do we need to know today? What do we need to know about God? Well, first of all, God is alive. The first part of that verse lets us know that. King Uzziah was dead, but God lives on. Psalm 90 in verse 2 says, "Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." God was the living God when this universe exploded into existence by His Word. He was the living God when Socrates drank that poison, hemlock, and killed himself. He was the living God when William Bradford governed Plymouth Colony. He was the living God even in 1966 when Thomas Altizer proclaimed that God was dead. God was still alive. And He'll be living 10,000 years from now. God is alive. Listen, in 120 years, this planet will be populated by maybe 10 billion brand new people. And all 6 billion of us alive today will be gone. But not God. He had no beginning, which means that He depends on nothing for His existence. He always has been, and He always will be alive. That's an important reality to know about God and who He is. Second, not only is God alive, God is in charge. In the second part of that first verse, He says, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. No vision of heaven has ever revealed God plowing a field. Never showed Him cutting grass. We never see Him filling out reports at the office. We never see Him loading up a truck. Heaven is not fighting to hold on against an army of attackers. God doesn't have to take a second job to make ends meet. He sits on a throne and He has absolute control. We don't give God authority over our lives. We did not make Him Lord. He is Lord whether we cooperate with Him or not. He's the Lord. He exercises authority whether we like it or not. The issues of your life and my life are not beyond the scope of His Lordship. He even controls the extent of our experiences. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 says that. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So any experience that we go through, God is in control the whole time. He doesn't stop being in control, and He decides how far and how much we have to experience that circumstance. God is in control. He is in charge. He is Lord. The question always is whether we're going to cooperate with Him as Lord. So God is alive, God is in charge, and God is omnipotent. That word is so important because God is not just powerful. He is all-powerful. That potent means that He's powerful. Omni means that He's powerful in everything. He's not just on a throne. He's on a throne high and lifted up. Just showing how He is above everything. The throne of God's authority is not one throne among many thrones. It is higher than every other throne. He has absolute power to exercise His will. In Isaiah chapter 46, in verse 10, the prophet writes, declaring the end from the beginning. God has in view the beginning of all things and the end of all things and everything in between, all at the same time. God doesn't travel through time like we do, wondering what's out there and trying to remember what was behind. No, God has chosen to walk with us, but at the same time, He is outside of all. So He is imminent, He's right there with us, but He's transcendent, He's outside of it all. So He sees the beginning and the end. Isaiah says, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Not a one of us can say that. Only God can. Daniel wrote in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35, He said, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. That's quite a way to start a statement. All of the inhabitants, that's all of us, are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, what have you done? God is all powerful. And by contrast, we're creatures. We are little specks on a little planet in a universe that is incomprehensibly large. As vast as that universe is, God made it. And not only did He make it, He made it by simply speaking it. He is all powerful. We're dependent. We need resources that are outside of ourselves. And where do we get those needs met? Sustained by the Lord Himself. The omnipotence of God is either wonderful when you think about it because He's for us, or it can be terrifying if He's against us. If we're indifferent to His power, if you just don't think about God's power and it doesn't matter to you, it's only because you're not paying attention. He's also magnificent. In the last part of that first verse, it says, and the train of His robe filled the temple. You've seen paintings of kings with the train of their royal robe just kind of following a few feet behind them. You've seen pictures or experienced brides with trains and that stretch over the steps of the platform and down the aisle a little bit. What would it mean if the train filled the aisles and covered over all the pews? It'd be a glorious thing, wouldn't it? A magnificent thing. God's robe filled the entire heavenly temple. His magnificence has no equal. There is nothing that we can speak of or describe that comes anything close to the magnificence of God, who He is. He's wonderful to look at, and He's absolutely royal in His majesty. And that's the way that Isaiah saw Him in that vision. He's also reverenced. In the first part of verse 2 and in the first part of verse 4, it says, above it stood seraphim. Each one had wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. Those strange creatures, those seraphim, they don't appear anywhere else in the Bible. Only here, in this. At least not by the same name, seraphim. If they're anywhere else, we don't see them by that name. And we don't see them by that description. And they are as powerful as the scene itself. According to verse 4, it says, and the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of Him who cried out. That's power. And yet, they can't look at the Lord directly. They don't even leave their feet exposed in His presence. They cover their feet and they cover their face. He is reverenced. An angel terrifies a man with his appearance and his power, but angels themselves hide in fear and reverence from the face of God. What a great God, a reverenced God. But also God is holy. In the first part of verse 3, it says, and one cried to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. Every effort to describe the holiness of God ends up in the same place. God is holy means God is God. The root meaning of the word holy is to cut or to separate. A holy thing is cut off and separated from common use. Earthly things and people are made holy when they're distinct from the world and devoted to God. That's what makes something holy. The Bible speaks of holy ground in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 5. In Exodus 12 and verse 16, it talks about holy assemblies. Another place, holy nation. holy garments. In 2 Peter, he talks about holy men who were moved by God. And also in chapter 3 of 1 Peter, he talks about holy women. Almost anything can become holy if it's separated from what's common in common use and is devoted to God. Think with me for a moment. What happens when this definition is applied to God Himself? From what can you separate God to make Him holy? The very Godness of God means that He's separate from all that's not God. Which means that God is one of a kind. He's in a class by Himself. He is completely holy. When we try to describe the holiness of God, we run out of language to use before we're able to describe the holiness of God. In fact, the prophet Habakkuk tells us that we should just stop trying. Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 20, "But the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him." Number 7, God is glorious. The second part of verse 3, the second part of verse 4, says the whole earth is full of His glory, and the house was filled with smoke. The glory of God is the manifestation of His holiness. The glory of God is the revelation of who He is. In Leviticus chapter 10, in verse 3, Moses said, "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all the people, I must be glorified." That's the kind of God that I want. That's the kind of God that I need. The power to handle my problems, no matter what they are, no matter how big they are. That's the kind of God that I want. That's the kind of God that I need. The kind of God with the knowledge to guide me through all the issues of life. An appearance that just captures my attention. A God that demands my allegiance. He doesn't just want to be my buddy and my friend. He demands my allegiance to Him. A God who is completely different from me in holiness, yet at the same time calls me to become just like Him in holiness. That's the kind of God that I want. That's the kind of God that I need. A God who forgives me and has purposes for me, and a God who is there for me whenever I need Him. That's the kind of God that I want. That's the kind of God that I need. And when I go through crisis, when things come into my life, that's the kind of God that I want. I want to have my view of God, my understanding of God, I want it nailed down before ever a crisis comes into my life. That I might be able to just rest in Him and trust Him. No matter how big or small the crisis is, no matter what the circumstances are or what they become. That I don't trust in myself or anything of this earth, but I can put my dependence fully on Him. Trust Him to take care of that problem. Trust Him to give me the guidance that I need. Trust Him to take me through it. How about you? In those events of life, those times of crisis, we need the bedrock foundation of trusting in the Lord who is God.